verses 10 to 19, and if you're following in the church Bibles, it's on page 30. So Genesis 28, starting at verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth, with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were descending and ascending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, Surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set up a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. I was going to go straight into it, but actually I just have to pause a minute and say thank you to Sharon and Phil on the organ and the choir and the band for leading us in that sung worship. We haven't fully collated your reviews of our new gatherings that will come, and we'll make those known in due course when we've had the time to do it. But I've already picked up the sense that, like me, there's just something I know that's appreciated about seeing and moving between the old and the new in our worship. And actually having the band, the choir, the organ. I love it in some of our modern songs where suddenly Phil or Adrian or Mark or somebody on the organ just lets that swell go. And I love it when we're singing an ancient hymn in a new way. And Rock of Ages has always been one of my favorites. So it's written quite near here. You may know that in Cheddar Gorge. This isn't part of the sermon, by the way, so if you're timing me, please stop. Cheddar Gorge, the chap who wrote it was out, and there was a sudden cloudburst, and to protect himself from the rain and the storm, he just happened to be walking past a cleft in the rock, and as he sheltered there and the rain thundered down, that's where he got the inspiration to write that song. And also, he has my favorite ever name of any hymn writer, Augustus Montacute Toplady. Come on. I mean, that is just amazing. You could almost stop there and you'd have been fed for the morning. Wonderful. Just a couple of other things by way of get-go before we carry on. The sunrise service prayer event that we're planning for the observatory next Sunday, 5 a.m., it seems to have gone a bit viral across the city. I've seen it on different blogs and websites and different things with the Together for Bristol and all the different prayer streams. So I think we're going to have quite a lot of people joining us. So I do hope there's going to be somebody from Christchurch. Jax will be there, but others as well. It would be wonderful to have you up at the observatory, 5 a.m., to pray over our city. And Sarah Wadsworth has very helpfully ordered a number of these because one of the national prayer events for the Islamic world, praying for Muslims during Ramadan, actually overlaps with Thy Kingdom Come. And we've got some of these, and if you feel drawn to pray for the Islamic world, these are free for you to take from the info hub today. It's great to have Adam and Jess with us. I think Jacob's gone down. I'm not preaching on Jacob just because you're here. So you might think, you know, I've been doing it for 3 weeks in the hope that you would finally turn up. But anyway, and Adam's actually preaching at the midweek on Wednesday to say farewell to the folk there as well, which is going to be special. Okay, last look for this time anyway. at this extraordinary passage in Genesis. Why Jacob and not Esau? The reason for asking that question, I want to just wrestle a little bit with the question that I know is alive for some people here, because one or two of you have already told me from previous weeks. Why, and this is the impression, why some people seem more amenable to encounter with God? I don't know whether you ever feel that yourself. Maybe you feel that, actually, why is it always Jacob, whoever Jacob represents, who gets these extraordinary things? You know, why do I just get to fall off ladders rather than seeing angels coming up and down them? You know, why Jacob and not me? And I just want to spend a little bit of time looking at that. I know it's not always easy to draw exact correlations between spiritual experience under the Old Covenant and our present spiritual experience since Christ. But I think there are similarities. If we look at Jacob, Jacob's only been in the biblical narrative for 3 chapters. So he's not old. He's a young adult. We know that he is in a pretty desperate stage in life. He is fleeing under threat of extreme violence from his brother, whom he's cheated. We know, but Jacob doesn't know, that he will never see his beloved mother Rebekah again. And if you read the early story of Jacob, he was your archetypal mummy's boy. Apron strings, whatever the Hebrew equivalent in the ancient Near Eastern was, but Jacob was hanging on. And he never sees his mother again. And we don't know a great deal about him. We don't know much about his spiritual experience, but it would appear, and I think this is the reality for many in our churches, that his experience of God until this moment is inherited, not inhabited. I don't know whether that makes sense to you. That his spiritual reality is inherited, not yet inhabited. We know that Jacob was conscious of God, certainly as a concept and very possibly more than a concept, because of the prayers of blessing and what he'd been taught by his father Isaac, which he himself had inherited from his father, Jacob's grandfather Abraham. And so there is a sense of inheritance. And I remember at the age of 14, I've mentioned a number of times, probably all of you know that I became a Christian at the age of 14. I'd been brought up, I'd inherited the faith, as it were. Now, doctors are recently telling us that actually when you're 14, you're not even really competent to cross the road. Did you read that in the press? That they're saying to parents, you know, don't let your kids cross the road on their own until they're 14, because they just don't have the spatial awareness to know where they are. Anyway, at the age of 14, I had sufficient perception to realize around that brethren youth campfire that I had to inhabit rather than inherit the experience of God. Now, I wouldn't have put it in those words, but I knew, and I could formulate this almost in words, I knew the time had come to be a child of God, not a grandchild of God, because God has no grandchildren. And that I had to make a choice. Was I going to live on the inherited faith of my parents, or was I going to begin to inhabit my own journey of faith with God? So I think there may be some similarities for some of us. And the difficulty with trying to address the question, I said to one of the people before the service began that I was going to answer it today. And then I walked back and said, actually, that's a really silly thing to say, because I don't know whether I will answer it to your satisfaction, but I'm going to address it. And actually, some of the reasons why some of us might initially struggle with the sense of experiencing God or encountering God or hearing God speak may be more needy of a pastoral conversation. And please, if what I say this morning doesn't satisfy or makes things worse, it has been known for vicars to make things worse. If that is the case, please connect with Roberto and Suzanne, with Tim, Kate, with Jackie, with me, with any one of the team, if you'd like to talk more, because it may be that there are pastoral things that we can help overcome, blockages that may be there that wouldn't necessarily be appropriate to put out, as it were, in a teaching, because then people might sit under that. Does that make sense? So I want to give that get out, if you like, for you. Come and talk if need be. It's interesting that people like Wesley, when he was in Bristol, speaking to 20,000, and he would see people in their hundreds collapse under the power of God's Spirit as he preached. And yet in his journals he records time after time after time again, I was left unmoved. And often I am somebody who feels other people have more evident, manifest experiences of God than I do. So be encouraged if you are feeling, why Jacob and not me? Something we clearly see in this scripture, and we must acknowledge, is that God is sovereign and God makes choices. And there is clearly an element in here, in this encounter, that God has made the sovereign choice to encounter, to reveal himself to Jacob. There is absolutely no indication in the scripture that Jacob himself is seeking experience of God. We don't really know what's going on in Jacob's mind. We can intuit and guess because of the situation in which he finds himself, but there is no indication that he is actively seeking or pursuing an encounter with God. It is God who chooses to reveal himself to Jacob through a dream. But if we talk of God's sovereign choice, I believe we must also speak of God's conscious desire, God's manifest desire for encounter. You cannot seriously read the written record of God in his word without seeing that God desires to meet with his people. It is plain as the words on the page. And so God's sovereign choice shows that grace operated well before the cross. God freely gave Jacob this experience. Is there then anything we can do to facilitate God's desire to have encounter with us? See, I do not buy what I've heard from people that, some people just have the right sort of temperament to encounter. I just don't buy that. Because I believe that God has made us, yes, very different, yes, temperamentally varied, yes, different in all sorts of ways, but God has placed the same hunger in us. Solomon once wrote that God has set eternity in the hearts of humankind. There is a hunger, a desire for God in the human heart because of what God has placed there. I don't believe it is gender related. I know sometimes people say, all this encounter stuff is a feminine thing. I don't buy it. I actually, a lot of the time, it's a struggle that the Bible is quite male in its orientation. It's written by men. It's often about men. But actually, in this, it comes to my aid because actually it is men who are having these profound, deep, often emotional encounters. It is David, the man, who writes the most extraordinary love language to God. It is Solomon who writes the Song of Songs about his passion for God. So I don't buy those arguments. And I believe there may be things we can do if we are hungry for encounter to make that easier. Now, the ice gets thinner the further I go. Because this is not some sort of magic slot machine where we put in the right equation, we do the right things, we act in a ritualistic way, and we will automatically get back what we're expecting. It's not like that. But it is like any relationship. And you're all aware that in relationship you can pursue the heart of the relationship or you can withdraw from it. We're aware of that. And so it is with God and our relationship with him. I want to talk, not for the first time, about worship. Because worship, it seems, is a hinge in this, a critical hinge. Because worship is both invitation and response. We opened with, come down, O love divine, seek thou this soul of mine. O comforter, draw near, within my heart appear. It's an old hymn, and yet it is a cry of invitation. Love divine, come down, visit thou this soul of mine. O comforter, draw near. The hymn writer knows that God delights in the invitation to draw near to his people. And that is an ancient truth. It's a truth in scripture, and it's true here today. So one of the first things we can do is actually offer the invitation. And I wonder how many of us worship outside Sunday gatherings. It's not something I can judge. I just don't know. But I invite you to ask the question. It's an invitation, but it's also a response. It's quite clear that Jacob worships God in response to encounter. God has appeared, and Jacob responds in worship. So our worship today under the new covenant is a reaction to Jesus. And Jesus himself said it, Luke 7:47, after he had forgiven the woman with the alabaster jar her sins. Whoever has been forgiven much loves much. Whoever's been forgiven little loves little. And maybe part of the problem with inherited faith that prevents inhabited faith is perhaps how much we understand we've been forgiven, how much we actually understand God's love, how much we actually spend time gazing, if you like, on the crucifixion. Rather unusually for an evangelical, I had for a while, I had to give it back because it belonged to a church and I'd forgotten that, so I gave it back. Did I say that aloud? I did, but anyway, I gave it back. But I had a crucifix on my wall. I keep on meaning to get another one. But actually a crucifix, which is not a very evangelical thing to do, but actually I found it the most profoundly helpful tool in my worship. Because as I looked at that physical representation, it reminded me how much I've been forgiven. It reminded me how deeply I am loved. So here is a fact of which I can be absolutely certain. Every single person in this room right now is somewhere on their journey with God in worship. I'm fairly sure that can't be contradicted. It could be that you haven't even started. It could be that you're here or there or wherever it is. The point is, that's a fact, and here's the choice. Every one of us has the choice, wherever we are, whether that place is going to be the place we stop or the place from which we walk on. And so any comparison with others becomes irrelevant, because this is the place I am, and God, this is where I've got to, and I want to travel further with you. And that helps to address another question, which again people have asked. One of the joys of journeying in a passage is that people can ask you questions during the week. And somebody said, well, what makes a place special? Why was this place special? I believe that Jacob's discovery is that any place can be special if we're alive to the reality of God's presence. There was nothing previously special about the place that had been known as Luz and is now called Bethel. There was nothing special about it. It became special because of encounter. Our buildings are not in and of themselves sacred, special spaces. They become special as we meet God within them. And I love the balance in verse 13. There's a slight, not confusion, but just an openness in the Hebrew in verse 13. If you read it in your translations, it will almost say there was this ladder, the angels were coming down, and above it was the Lord. If you have a Bible with footnotes, the footnote will say that the Hebrew can mean either above or beside or around. And I just love that Hebrew openness, because it contains something of the majesty of God, and I want to come back to that in a moment, the majesty of God, who is eternally above, who is eternally majestic, splendid, glorious. And yet that same God, in the same moment, can be both above and beside and around us. And it's interesting, before those words, I realized them through practicing this, I've just had an experience twice recently, once on a Sunday gathering, once in staff worship, and all I can say was, the sense was that God was both there and right here. And I think that's Jacob's experience. And I think maybe for Jacob, he had been taught, he'd inherited the truth, and it is true that God is up there. Come down, O love divine. And that was his inherited faith. But now he's inhabiting the reality that God is right there beside him. I'm going to attempt a bit of a balance now. I don't know whether any of you have had the glorious responsibility, either as a parent or as a teenager, or of a teacher, of getting a teenager through exams. Anybody had that? And probably if you have a child who, let's say, is not exactly a duck to water in this whole exam business, if that means anything to you. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. So we're there. The balance is, as a parent, my experience may not be yours, is to exert sufficient pressure that said child can do their best, but not such pressure that they feel a failure compared to others. Does that make sense? So you're getting a balance. And I think as a church leader, there are times where a similar balance is attempted in terms of just trying to encourage people that little bit further. And that's what I want to do this morning. I just want to talk, about lifting hands in worship, okay? And I know that that's not for everybody, and some people are uncomfortable with it. And let me say, that was me. I've had to learn it. I've had to practice it. There are times, probably you see me with my arms up if you're watching, because I'm at the front. That's the reason you sit. There are times in these gatherings, it is a struggle for me to raise my arms because I don't feel like it. It's not really... if I wanted to play the temperament card, I would do what others sometimes do and keep my hands in pockets, preferably my own pockets. But actually, I've just felt this encouragement of God. Now, I want to tell you a story, and I'm irritated because I can't remember the person. It's a famous Christian. He became a Christian, I think, in the 1980s at a Billy Graham rally. He went every single night, and he sat right at the back, whether it was Wembley Stadium, wherever it was. And he was always next to the same steward. And Billy Graham would finish his address and make his appeal. And the man would stay in his seat. And the steward would say, "Are you going forward?" And the first night he said, no. If I want to do this, I can do it right here in my seat. And the steward said, "No, you can't. You've got to go to the front." Really irritated him. Second night, though, he was back in the same seat near the same steward. Same thing happened. Billy Graham finished his thing. And the guy said, "I'm not going anywhere. I can do it here." And the steward said, "No, you can't. You've got to go to the front." They really annoyed him. But he came back third night, fourth night. Fifth night, Billy Graham closed his address. The guy got up and started down the steps. This is not at all an emotional story, so I don't know why I'm doing this. The guy started down the steps, and the steward said, "Where do you think you're going? If you want to follow Jesus, you can do it right here in your seat." Now, the point of that is that that guy had reached the point where he was no longer determined to have God on his terms. Does that make sense? And all I can do is share, I've got this badly wrong. If anybody here now is sitting there thinking, feeling under pressure that the vicar wants you to raise your hands for the sake of it, I'm simply sharing my testimony that in wrestling through my temperamental disregard of and dislike of that practice, I learnt to worship in a new way. I can't say it's going to happen for everybody. If I was an Anglo-Catholic, I'd probably be having a similar conversation with you about genuflecting and... No, that's not genuflecting, that's genuflecting, making the sign of the cross. And it only struck me today, I was thinking, I've talked a lot about raising hands and what it signifies. It struck me today for the first time as I was walking here to church that raising hands is the universal sign of surrender. And I just wonder whether that is why some of us find it difficult. Because it would represent a surrender to God. So, I don't know where this is going to go with you in your heart and mind. If I've offended you, please forgive me. Come and tell me so I can say sorry face to face. But I hope I might have encouraged you in that. Like that guy at the back of the Billy Graham. When the moment comes, perhaps, that you're willing to do that, you might not need to. I don't know. But I know that God is inviting us and longing for us to respond. Two closing thoughts, and then we'll return to our sung worship. When Jacob awoke, and realized what had happened. Verse 17 records that he was afraid and said, "How fearful, how awesome is this place?" And it ties in with that sense of God being both above and beside. And there are times, and it's absolutely right, when we teach, and we do teach, that God wants to be our brother, our friend, our companion, our close by. But let's not forget that he's also the God of glory. And it's not that we need to be afraid in the sense of recoil, but we need to reverence. It's interesting, isn't it? If you fear something, you recoil from it and you end up further away. If you reverence something in the high church, you know, down at the cathedral, if we process in with our robes, we'll often do what they call reverencing the altar. You can ask me about that later, but the point is you make a bow towards it. And this is the distinction of awe. It is not to produce the fear that makes us recoil from, but it is the jaw-dropping awesomeness of God that invites us to bow, in which case we come nearer him. Does that make sense? If you fear, you recoil, you end up further away. If you reverence, you bow, and you end up nearer. And that's the biblical understanding of fear of the Lord. And this building, because of God's presence, needs to be a fearful and awesome place. And I urge you, particularly those of us who don't find that experiential side of faith immediately easy, to do what Jesus encouraged in Luke 11. Keep asking, keep seeking, keep knocking. Jesus said that specifically in relation to the visitation of the Holy Spirit. I know, we've discovered in years of ministry, Jackie and I, that the sense of God's presence in a building, that sense of fearsome, awesome presence, is a powerful evangelistic tool. We know people who are believers today, not because of great teaching, not because of tracts, but because they came into a place that was made special by the encounters that people have there. And they just walk into God and meet him. Encounter always has a purpose. I just want to say, if you think, and I know we all have this experience, that God hides his face from us, we may feel that. Let me just tell you a truth about God. God never hides things from us, but he often hides things for us. Just the way that parents do for their children. If you're parents, you've hidden things for children to find, and don't you just love it as they go about and the joy at finding? That's the way God hides things, not from us, but for us. And I love the way that at the end of this encounter, I talked in my first talk about the extraordinary roughness of a stone for a pillow and just how that jarred. And yet somehow the fact that Jacob lived under the power of prophetic blessing enabled him to take the rough rocks of his circumstance and rest there. And now that little image is completed because the stone that became the pillow becomes the pillar. And it was in the very midst of that, the very midst of circumstances that became worship for Jacob. Throughout this brief encounter, there's a repeated sense of God's faithfulness to what he's promised. And this is what I want to end with, particularly for those who may be struggling with some of what I've taught this morning. God is endlessly faithful to what he has promised. Verse 13, promise of land. Verse 14, promise of descendants. Verse 15, promise of land again. And in verse 15, you can look at it later, God says to Jacob, "I will not leave you until I have fulfilled what I have promised." 4 chapters later in Genesis 32, perhaps an even more famous encounter between Jacob and God occurs, the one where Jacob wrestles through the night. I believe it is this encounter with the ladder and hearing God say, I will not leave you until I have fulfilled what I promised. I believe it is that encounter, those words of God, that enables the next encounter and Jacob's words to God, I will not let you go until you bless me. And for everybody who is hungry to encounter God, for everybody who is asking, seeking, knocking, I encourage you to make that your prayer. To respond to the God who is endlessly faithful to what he's promised. Who says through Jacob to us, I will not leave you until I have fulfilled what I have promised. I invite your response. I will not let you go until you bless me. In that spirit, can I invite us to stand and Sharon, the choir, the band, the organ will lead us back into a time of response. Just to say that our children went down a little later this morning, so we've got a little bit more time. Just we can go through to about 25 to without treading on our wonderful kids' team's toes. So let's relax into this time. I want to be very clear that it isn't my place to judge the way we worship. I can simply unfold the message that I believe God has given me. The choice is yours and the response is yours. Father, I thank you for this 3 weeks in Genesis 28. I thank you for this one example of your encounter with a member of the human race. Lord, I believe that you stand ready by the presence of your Spirit to meet every single person now. Lord, I acknowledge it's a mystery, but I know that you long to meet with your people. So we knock and we seek and we ask. Reveal yourself, sovereign Lord. To me. We knock, we seek, we ask. Reveal yourself, sovereign Lord, to me.